Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Welcome to today's roundtable on the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston CBDC project. I'm Patricia Haas Cleveland, Omfit president for the U.S., and I'm very pleased to have Jim Cunha join us today. Jim is Senior Vice President for Secure Payments and FinTech at the Boston Fed and has been with the Fed for 37 years. This discussion is part of a series of discussions in OMFIF's Digital Monetary Institute, a curated forum that focuses on issues at the intersection of digital technology, financial services, and the regulatory world. Today, we are focused on the Boston Fed CBDC project, Project Hamilton. The topic could not be more timely. Discussion about CBDCs have gone from a back burner debate in past years to a frontline priority today. This has been driven by a range of developments, from a desire to improve payments and financial inclusion for the unbanked, to the decline in the use of cash, the exploding interest in cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and the introduction of stablecoins, and perhaps most notably, continued technological innovation, which is changing the face of finance. And the COVID pandemic has only accelerated these trends. While much of the debate is still in the discussion stage, the Boston Fed has, over the past 6 months, been proactively developing a digital dollar prototype in collaboration with MIT Media Lab. Fed Chairman Jay Powell has alluded to this work, but is also known to have said it's more important to get a CBDC right rather than to get it fast, a priority that is no doubt at the forefront of the Fed's Project Hamilton effort. So we are delighted to have Jim here today to tell us how to get it done right and hopefully fast enough. Jim, I'd like to start to just clarify at the outset two points you mentioned earlier that may benefit everybody to understand. First, that your focus is on the technology side of a potential CBDC, not on the policy side. So you're not going to talk about if and when we might decide to issue a digital dollar, but rather the technology that might enable that and what's important to look at. And secondly, that the focus is on a retail CBDC, not a wholesale CBDC, which is the focus of many other central banks' efforts. So just to turn to this, I'd like you to tell us, if you could, about Project Hamilton, how it began, the nature of the collaboration with MIT, and also if you could comment on the second project you're working on related to CBDCs, which is analyzing 40 or so technology platforms that may be relevant for this exercise. And obviously, I think everyone will be interested in, are these two projects related or how might they have a bearing on each other? So thank you very much, Jim.
Well, thanks, Patricia. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation. I'll give the normal Fed disclosure. These are my words, not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve System. But we started looking at central bank digital currency really back in 2015. We actually were one of the first central banks to look at wholesale and taking the books of the Fed and putting them on a distributed ledger platform. We did that from 2016 to 2018 and published a paper. And then this past year, with the developments with China, with Diem and many others, we, like many central banks, pivoted to look at a retail model versus a wholesale model. And we decided to partner with MIT, specifically the Digital Currency Initiative, or DCI, because they've been in existence for 5 years doing experiments and coding and testing CBDC platforms. We thought they were amongst the best in the world, also right outside my door here in Boston. And so the goal of that work, really, as you mentioned, technology in nature. So we have a joint technology research arrangement with them. We're designing together, we're coding together, testing. And the goal is to build a prototype CBDC. So a prototype would be a smaller scale version, not a full production system. But the goal is to determine if we can meet the needs of the U.S. And so in the first phase of that work, Project Hamilton, is to determine if we can build a platform that can mint, store, transfer, and extinguish money, CBDC, to the needs of the U.S., specifically to the scale, to the speed, certain privacy considerations in a U.S. context. So, for instance, settlement in a matter of seconds, or speed to handle, we haven't set the number, but magnitudes of tens of thousands of transactions per second. So can we build and test it to meet those unique needs? Our goal is to get that done by middle of 21, and then publish research jointly with MIT and create an open source license for the code. We'll then go into future phases. You mentioned that we're not setting policy, but we have to consider policy because policy affects a design, how you build a system. So we'll take various policy options and determine how we code them and what some of the trade-offs are. So two big ones are privacy and traceability. How do you build it so it's private enough that people want to use it, but also you have enough information data to do your customer, anti-money laundering, counter-terrorist financing, et cetera. So it's important to be able to match those sometimes conflicting needs. So we'll be designing those, coding them, testing them, and see whether we can do it in a way that still meets the original throughput speed considerations, because more programming added to a system will likely slow it down and create other potential bottlenecks. And that will last from 1 to 2 years. We're flexible as far as how long that lasts, but we're really trying to understand how much of a system we can build and test in this prototype environment. We have no decision to go to pilot, which would be a logical next phase, or production, as you mentioned. The other project we have, which is only the Boston Fed and not MIT, is to look at 40 or so platforms that exist today. They could be open source, distributed ledger type platforms like the Hyperledger variations or Ethereum, Corda, et cetera, or private sector actors who have actually built a system that they say can meet the US needs. The comparison analysis will then shake out what we think are the top 3 or 4 platforms. We'll bring them in and we'll test them. That testing won't be quite as robust as what we're doing with MIT, but we want to make sure we can still see if these platforms meet the needs of the U.S. The goal here really is within the next 2 years, say, or so, that we have a good sense of what's possible technically and to position ourselves to be able to act either because we decide to act or because Congress mandates that we take a step forward with CBDC. So it's really positioning ourselves for whatever the next steps are. I should also mention that the Board of Governors in Washington are also working on something called the Tech Lab, where they're bringing in a number of platforms for testing at a much more superficial level, but still valuable as far as learning what's possible. And our systems complement each other. And so if you look at, across all three of them, we'll have a really good base of understanding what technically is possible.
Thanks, Jim. That's a great oversight of those two projects. Certainly a lot going on in each of them, and useful, no doubt, for you that they're going on parallel tracks. I'd like to just go back to Project Hamilton for a second and look under the hood a bit. You talked about how it began with the MIT, the joint collaboration, but could you elaborate a bit on what actually Project Hamilton is trying to solve for? We know that there's a need out there to have greater access to financial services for the unbanked. We know there's a great need out there to improve the efficiency of the payment system. And we know there's pressure out there to keep up with other countries' initiatives. So is there sort of a primary driver behind the project that you can speak to?
Yeah, the real primary driver is to position ourselves to act if we should decide to in the future. All those other things you mentioned, Project Diem for Facebook, for instance, or China or others, I think those are motivations. But as Chair Powell said, we'd rather get it right than be first. So our goal is, you know, it's like the thing about banking in the early days of the World Wide Web and the Internet. Most banks were looking at it because they didn't think it would be a trusted, secure platform for banking. And then once certain banks started getting on board and it grew, then it became apparent that one, it's possible that you can run securely over the World Wide Web, but also it became table stakes, became a cost of doing business. So every bank in the U.S. has a web presence today. There's a slight corollary to central bank digital currency or digital monies. At some point where it'll need to be issued because of the need out there, but also because it'll be table stakes for how currencies work today, safely and securely, but in digital form. I say one of the motivations for me personally has always been trying to help solve the unbanked problem. In the U.S., there are something like 6 or 7% of the people are unbanked, and many who are underbanked, which means they go to check cashers and payday lenders. And so I think CBDC, I think, has potential for greater financial inclusion just because of the nature of how it works. So imagine someone who, instead of getting a check, going to a check cashier, maybe a payday lender, maybe remittances, or maybe money orders to help pay bills, can somehow get a CBDC and make all those transactions via CBDC. Now, I think that could be, you know, very empowering to those who are unbanked and to stop the people who can least afford to pay some of those fees from paying those fees. So there's some social motivation, at least in my mind, in what a CBDC can solve. But also it's about choice. You know, if we created a CBDC and nobody wanted it, nobody used it, it's useless. It's a waste of time. But we want to offer choice. We want to offer a paper currency. And if in the future it's determined that there's a need there because of congressional action or because of demand from the public, we want to be ready to meet those needs.
Yeah, that's very clear. I'd like to just come back to one point you mentioned earlier, which is potential pressure from the outside, such as the U.S. Congress. We know that several lawmakers, both in the CARES Act, but specifically Congressman Bill Foster and French Hill, have urged the Fed to catch up with other countries, specifically China, who has not only launched a domestic digital dollar, but is expected to potentially go beyond China's borders via the Belt and Road Initiative. So we're hearing a lot about concerns that China's domestic currency will go global, potentially sort of threatening the dollar's role as an international currency. But to do that, a lot of technical issues have to be addressed. We've sort of touched on some of these. So I have really two questions for you. What in your mind are the key issues that have to be addressed first, the characteristics that have to be incorporated in the design, and what does it mean for you if, in fact, there is a lot of pressure from the Congress to accelerate a digital dollar and how you design the product?
Yeah, I think some of the fundamental requirements you have to be able to meet to be able to create a functioning CBDC that would be accepted. One is throughput. You know, no one's going to wait minutes for a transaction to complete, so it's going to be settled in seconds. It's going to be the speed of which it has to be and the volume of the network traffic. Otherwise, as an ecosystem, it won't survive because it won't be able to handle the traffic. But also, there's a fair amount of issues relative to privacy, both over the holder of the currency, whether it's a wallet or some other technology, how secure is that? How safe is their money? But also the platform has to be resilient against cyber attacks, be they from nation states, from bad guys who are just trying to counterfeit the digital currency, or even from denial of service or spam type attacks. So it's really fundamental that the system operate in a way that creates trust and the system stays up and is able to stop attacks. So I'd say some of those are the fundamental requirements of a system like this.
So if there is a pressure to accelerate, obviously there are certain basic characteristics you've pointed out, particularly around cyber, that have to be embedded and addressed. But what about other aspects? I mean, we talked about before, you know, privacy versus transparency, know your customer, these sorts of things. I guess that'll be balance as to compromising or not compromising, but ensuring that the design features can be accelerated if they need to be. I'm not suggesting this, and I don't mean to put you in an awkward spot, but we're just aware all of a sudden everybody is interested in this, and when people are interested in something, they often want it yesterday. So we are watching eagerly how you tackle all this.
Yeah, a few thoughts on that. I think it's a few things worth mentioning. You mentioned some of the CARES Act bill that did not make it in. So what we're trying to do is position ourselves for whatever the decision is. But, you know, to be totally honest, you don't build a safe, secure, resilient, ubiquitous system for, you know, the public of the United States in a year. It's just not technically feasible. So if we waited 2 years, and then that action happened, we'd be 2 years behind. So we're just trying to position ourselves to be as far along. And it's also those policy choices have trade-offs that we need to understand deeply. As I mentioned before, privacy versus traceability for anti-money laundering. In today's way of doing it, it relies on the banking environment to do the know your customer, anti-money laundering, et cetera. And we don't know what the future is going to be as far as how that's going to work. So we're trying to experiment with different ways of thinking about privacy versus the traceability. And many of the central banks are grappling with the same thing. That's an area where innovation or even new technology may be able to get a better balance of privacy and stopping the bad guys.
Let me just turn back a second to sort of the technology platforms that are out there that you touched on. I guess there's a question, even though the technology platform for Project Hamilton is not decided, are there any insights or thoughts you have about that? There's a lot of interest, you know, is this going to focus exclusively on DLT-based platforms versus a centralized ledger? And I know there's a lot of interest also in the ability to connect a potential CBDC or use it for cross-border purposes, and the ability to link or be interchangeable with other central bank digital currency. Is there anything you can elaborate on, just on your thinking around the type of platform that might be adopted?
First, we are technology agnostic. We're not presuming that it is or is not a distributed ledger. Our work with MIT specifically is going to go where the results take us. So they've been deeply steeped for 5 years, as I mentioned, in coding and experimenting with different platforms. So we're agnostic there. In the review we're doing of 40 platforms or so, we do have a number of distributed ledger systems there. And it could be that the system that exists today isn't quite right or quite robust enough to meet the needs of the future. So we're looking at distributed ledger and not. We presume that there'll be some sort of a distributed nature to this because we can't have a single point of failure. You know, we can't have one data center with one database with one engine running all this. So we know there's some distribution model within the design of it, either both for resiliency, but also for potentially for throughput. So it's really casting a wide net looking broadly. That's also why we're creating an open source license. You know, it could be that someone takes the building at MIT and approves of it, and that becomes a future base. We really believe what we're building is a potential base for a future platform. And that platform could have a combination of distributed ledger as part of it, not. I think it's the central bank in Italy that is building distributed ledger for a component of a system, you know, not to move the money, but for data purposes. And so there's a number of combinations that we can have with this, and we have to have an open mind. We can't presume that it exists today.
So thank you for that. I think there's just a couple of other questions that come up around sort of the nature of it. There's a lot of interest if the policy decision is made, the technology is decided, how does it actually go from being, you know, a prototype to actually functioning? And in that context, you know, how will this relate to the FedNow project you've got going on? And are you looking at solutions for offline CBDC payments? There's a number of questions around sort of how it will actually play out. Can you just comment on that?
Yeah, a lot packed in there. But first of all, we are looking at eventually offline. It's not part of our first phase here. But I can't imagine a digital currency that can't operate when you're out of cell coverage or when you're in the train station or something. So we think there has to be an offline capability there. Now, it comes with challenges, obviously, technically, and also risk. Offline transactions, by definition, may not be as validated as when the network's up. So there may be risk actions you can take there. Relative to FedNow, which has also happened to be developed here in the Boston Fed, you know, we see it as a complementary, just like cash and electronic payments are today. You know, we in the U.S. are lucky we have so many choices, but we keep building new ones because there are still needs out there existing payment systems don't meet. So we see this complementary. Now, because it's digital in nature, obviously it can be used in places that physical currency can't, like over the internet, or certain point of sale options. So we do think existing any new payment system in the U.S. has the chance that it competes against others. But here in the U.S., we have never extinguished a single payment system in the entire time I've been in the Fed, 37 years. So I do think there's plenty of room for new options and new ways of thinking about it. And then as I see it, innovation happens also around payment systems. So one of the technology questions we get are, or policy questions is, will a CBDC basically squash innovation. And I see it just the opposite. I think if we have a CBDC, it can be innovation around it that we can't even imagine at this stage of the thing. I mean, that's what the private sector does so well, is innovating and meet users' needs. And I think that's what's going to happen with the CBDC. So I see it as complementary, but there's obviously some competition there. But I do see it as a potential platform to, as I mentioned before, help the unbanked, underbanked, as one example. And down the road, potentially the Internet of Things, you know, from a payments perspective and a perspective in a way that is safe and efficient.
And it's great that you reiterated the importance of innovation and using this as a platform for innovation. And it basically implies the importance of sort of collaboration between the public sector and the private sector and doing things in tandem and really trying to add to the net good, the net increase in improvements in our payment system, as opposed to proceeding either in isolation or in arenas where the two sides aren't engaged together. I'd just like to ask you one question, and that is, we've talked a lot about the U.S. and what's going on here, but I'd love to know, given the initiatives going on elsewhere, we talked about China. We know that elsewhere in Bank of England, ECB, Switzerland, Sweden, numerous emerging market, there's a lot going on around central bank digital currencies, from the exploratory to even beyond that stage. To what extent do you and your central bank colleagues elsewhere collaborate or share information? Because ultimately, from a technology perspective and a regulatory perspective, all of this will have to work synergistically. Otherwise, it'll be a big setback for the global economy. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mentioned we started with the wholesale experimentation back in 2016. And unbeknownst to us, Singapore, Canada, and England were all doing the same thing. So if you look at the leaders on the wholesale side, you know, we were amongst them. And what we would do is we would actually physically get together, physically once or twice a year, and share our experiments, conference calls. Our goal was always to help each other do the best we possibly can. In the case of Canada and Singapore, they actually did joint experimentation. And so we continue that dialogue today bilaterally with a number of central banks. For instance, Canada is interested in privacy. Japan is interested in offline. So we have conversations with them that we think will, you know, continue forward. And also the BIS issued a paper on motivations for CBDC that seven central banks, including the Fed, contributed to. And in that paper, the next steps talk about us continuing to share and potentially jointly experiment together. Because we really believe that this is something that, you know, we can all gain better by sharing and by partnering with private sector, with universities, et cetera. You mentioned moving forward in interoperability before, but also in working together, the platforms working together. And we don't presume there's only one way of doing this that all central banks have to adopt. But we do have to think about interoperability across country lines for remittances or even on the wholesale side. So some of the experimentation we'll be doing going forward, I think eventually will be some of that interoperability. Doesn't have to be the same technology, but probably has to be built on the same standards in the same ways of managing, you know, moving money across multiple platforms. So a lot of coordination there that'll only continue and grow.
Yeah. And that, of course, is very encouraging to hear, because obviously if progress is being made in some countries, the opportunity to benefit from that and collaborate just enables greater progress all across the board. And it's great to know that you are publishing your research, your findings, and it'll all be open source. So I think that enables others to leverage your work as well. Well, we're just about at the end of our time. I wanted to thank you, but also ask you one last question, and that is really one that you may well not have an answer to. Even though we've learned a lot today, I would say what we still don't know is, will a digital dollar actually become a reality? And I just go back to a few points that we've heard, which is that some will argue that between cash, credit cards, other payment mechanisms, plus an eventual real-time settlement and payment system, a digital dollar will be less important. And you yourself mentioned one of the risks is that if it's not used, then that will defeat the ultimate purpose if you do have one. On the other hand, we've heard from folks such as the congressmen who are urging the Fed to develop a digital dollar for competitive reasons and other reasons. And then we have this very active current generation of mobile users and a very large community of unbanked who are keenly searching for easy, cost-efficient, and more accessible payment options, which digital currencies might help solve. So there's a lot going on out there. I guess the jury is out, but the train seems to be moving. It's certainly out of the station. And we will watch with great interest what your project comes up with, and if the digital dollar prototype that you come up with, in fact, can help provide solutions to some of these issues. Clearly, you have your hands full listening to Chairman Powell that you have to do it right. And the question is, will you be able to do it fast enough for the Congress or some of these other interests? But thank you so much for your thoughts. We really appreciate it. Is there anything you'd like to add or mention kind of as a closing remark?
Yeah, I use the words that I'm asked. Is it inevitable? You know, is it definitely going to happen? You know, inevitability is a long time sometimes. So I believe, my personal opinion is a digital currency is inevitable. You know, how far, how long? I mean, it takes years to build these platforms and do it right. So I don't see anything in the nearest terms as far as real, you know, decisions. I think it was Governor Brainard that said, you know, it takes, you know, extensive discussion with the industry, the public, everybody to try to make a decision like this. So there's a lot of even just policy discussion. So I think it's inevitable. How long? I don't know. But I do think, you know, we're starting down that track to where, you know, where it's going to be in our lifetime. I would say at least that much. And I think the other piece of it is nothing stays still. You know, I mean, things constantly change. So, you know, a currency was designed a long time ago. It's physical. It has limitations because of its physical nature. I can't imagine that there isn't going to eventually be the right use cases, the right motivations, the right desire to make it work. But like I said, timing obviously matters significantly. But.
Yeah. Well, I think, Jim, that's a great note to end this roundtable on. Again, thank you. It's been great to really pull back the curtain and hear a little bit about what's going on with the Boston Fed's projects, both with MIT and your other exploratory work on platforms. And as I said, we very much look forward to see how it plays out and to see how it might be a useful solution for some of the issues we've identified. So with that, thank you very much again, and we look forward to having you back at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Patricia. It's been a pleasure, and yeah, lots to come.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.